like big butts, and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny.
What'd you get, boss?
Just a message from the Black Tiger.
The hearts of men. The shadow knows.
Sorry to interrupt, boys.
The shadow.
Yes,
the shadow.
Out over the cold hills to the state's prison.
The shadow comes for revenge.
The computer's going to tell us who the shadow is.
The shadow knows.
Surely you're not afraid of death.
Crime does not pay. The Shadow knows.
Agents of the Shadowcast, report to the only podcast devoted exclusively to the mysterioso exploits of the two-fisted prince of the pulp pistoliers, the Dark Avenger. The Shadow. Didn't expect me back so soon, did ya? See, I admit that while I have made a few episodes the last couple of years, I have been really, really bad at follow-ups. I actually had a couple of ideas in the can, and I have been wanting to get back to the Shadowcast for some time on a much more regular basis, so enjoy this much more regularly timed edition of the Shadowcast, and it is a special one. Ladies and gentlemen, the theme of this particular season of the Shadowcast is the shadow on the silver screen. And of course, arguably the most faithful and certainly one of the most popular incarnations of the shadow, popular in its day, and for some reason still enduringly popular. People find this all the time on YouTube and elsewhere. I think it's public domain now, maybe. It is, of course, the 1940 film serial starring Victor Jory and produced by Columbia Studios. And this is one of those classic artifacts, one of those classic 1930s, 40s serials. It came on the heels of a number of other successful ones, however, and its history, and indeed its future, was closely tied in with another pulp character, a frankly scandalous imitation of the Shadow, known as the Spider. And they would be sort of woven together. There's some interesting kind of psychodrama and rights drama that went into all of that. But basically, the long and short of it is, folks, this was a big, big deal at the time. Film serials were hot. You can really think of them as the television shows of their day. Television, as you will learn if you watch this film serial, and it is widely available on the internet and, of course, on DVD, is, you know, television was still in its infancy. It was still being worked on. In fact, there's a chapter in this serial where they say, we're still experimenting on the concept of television.
Now, you're all my friends, and I know you hope this is going to be a big success.
I thought television was only in an experimental stage.
Not exactly. We've made a lot of progress.
You have to keep in mind, this was written and produced in 1939. It was released at the beginning of the serial season in early 1940, but it was basically a product of the late 1930s. And that might be why this is so good. There is something about 30s Shadow that just beats 40s Shadow. I can't put my finger on it. Not that there's not great stuff in the 1940s on radio and elsewhere. We just reviewed one, The Shadow Returns, which I enjoy very much. I like all of those monogram-produced Shadow films. I think they have a lot of entertainment value, although they are admittedly quite distant from the ideal. However, there are Shadow fans who swear to this day that the Shadow 1940 film serial is the closest we have ever come to the true pulp incarnation of the Shadow, and probably that's a product of exigency. Because the radio show was hopping at this time. The comic books were rolled out this same year as the film serial. There was an increasing emphasis on merchandising and expanding this franchise into what essentially amounts to the very first proper multimedia superhero sensation in American pop culture. Every superhero after this, from Superman to Batman to Spider-Man to the X-Men, really follows the model set in the 1930s and 40s by The Shadow, and really this is sort of the heart of that typhoon at the time. This is really when this started to intensify. 1930 and 1940. Really, the years from 1937 to 1940, five or so, were a period of unprecedented popularity for The Shadow. Sadly, as many of those years towards the end were wartime years, it was also a period where the pulp was somewhat embattled. And as it turned out, in the longer term, that sort of creative hothouse that, of course, provided the initial creative impetus for The Shadow being hamstrung in the way it was. I'm, of course, referring here to the wartime paper rationing that necessitated The Shadow drop to monthly and then I think even to quarterly ultimately. The point being, they reduced the size of the magazine, they reduced the regularity of the publication. That sent Walter Gibson off pursuing other work, and ultimately he wasn't writing The Shadow for a while. There was a lot of stuff that went down, and it was really stemmed from World War II and the massive hit that the pulp publication industry took that it never honestly recovered from. The pulp field kind of limped on for the duration of the 1940s. We're talking hero pulps now, because pulps in some form or another still kind of exist today in a weird way. They sort of transitioned into becoming the yellow paperbacks of the 1950s and 60s. In that sense, James Bond is a pulp character. He's just was never in a pulp magazine, if you take my meaning. But like those Conan yellow paperbacks and the Solomon Kane ones and the Elric and all the stuff that I love, right? That's kind of the natural inheritance of the yellow paperbacks. Those eventually turned into the great big bookstop paperback fantasy that we see in even modern day bookstores, right? The genre stuff and all that, you know, in a weird way, it's all kind of the inheritance of the pulp industry. But it is no exaggeration to say the hero pulps did not survive the 1940s, which is interesting because we begin the decade here with the Shadow film serial. And because, as I alluded to, there was so much expansion of the franchise, we were beginning to have issues with rights. We were beginning to have issues with crossover. And certain projects, a movie project here, a radio project, at one point a stage play that I'll talk about in a moment, that wound up being kind of at loggerheads in terms of rights. And so, in order to play it safe here, because we had already had The Shadow Strikes and International Crime, we needed to steer clear of the inspirations for those two movies. And so, in order to differentiate it and avoid stepping on rights holders' toes, it was put forward by Columbia that they would be adapting three pulp novels. We'll be reviewing the foremost of which at the end of today's show. That would be The Lone Tiger from 1939. But it's a trilogy of novels. It's The Green Hoods, The Silver Skull, and The Lone Tiger, and a radio episode called Prelude to Terror. And elements of all of these find themselves in there. Watching this, however, I think there's more than that, and we'll talk about that as we go. But to sort of summarize, I've seen Shadow fans and pulpiteers describe the Shadow serial as sort of the one that almost got it right. I think there's even an article in one of the pulp reprints that calls it that. It's the movie that almost got it right. I must admit, I think that is an accurate verity. Look at it visually. With the exception of the bandana over his mouth, this is the most pulp-accurate incarnation of the celluloid shadow. Note that I say pulp-accurate, as for all its faults, the 1994 Shadow movie is impressively earnest, at least with regard to all Shadow media, comics included, hence the trench coat and red scarf, which are rarely ever employed in the pages of the pulps, although they are seen on the covers. The literary Shadow is described as a creature of blackness, unlike Rachel Dolezal. In fact, it's germane to news of this week. The all-black pulp version of The Shadow, no red scarf included, is going to be released by Mezco Toys, the action figure manufacturer who made Spectacular. They're making a Doc Savage, they made a Solomon Kane figure, and they did a superb version of The Shadow recently. They're making a limited collector's version that comes in like a Shadow Club box, a Shadow Club pin. It comes with a girasol ring. I mean, the whole nine yards. They're going out for this thing, and he doesn't have the red scarf. This is the Walter Gibson, really more so the Tom Lavelle
version of The Shadow. So I thought I would mention that before we move on with reviewing this 1940 film serial. But look at the visual incarnation of this character in the 1940 serial. In place of a damn Dracula cape, a judge's robe. And in lieu of an eye-catchingly improbable scarlet scarf, I guess for blending into red curtains or something, a high upturned collar combined with a low-brimmed slouch hat. If not for that cringy COVID face diaper, this would be the ideal incarnation of the character's costume. It is ripped from the pages of the pulp. Let's be honest, digging into this thing, actually watching it, The Shadow could wear a crop top and bib overalls, and still the diabolical, spine-chilling laugh of Victor Jory as The Shadow would still absolutely carry this thing.
Judge, I ain't gonna take the rap. I'll talk!
Don't listen to him, Judge. That guy's liable to say anything to protect himself.
What do you mean, sir? Arrest that man!
The Shadow!
Yes, The Shadow.
In an interview in 1980, Victor Jory, thank God he lived long enough to talk about some of this stuff. Not only did he say he was probably going to be recognized most for The Shadow, he emphasized, you know, I had to get that laugh right. He said everybody knew that laugh, even people who didn't listen to the radio show every Sunday afternoon. It was a thing, kind of like a catchphrase. The Shadow Knows was a popular saying. Comedians on the radio joked about it. So I practiced that chuckle until I felt I had it right. You wanted it to give the kids goosebumps. That was the idea. Nailed it, Mr. Jory. Absolutely nailed it. Look at his aquiline profile, too. And he's a tall man. So he's like 6'1", 6'2". He's not a short man. People kind of look at Victor Jory, I think, and assume that he's a smaller man for some reason. No. Very tall, built, right? He's actually in physical shape. It had to be a physical actor. And this is a bit of a coup, too. This is coming off of a number of very prominent films for Victor Jory. So this is an actor with real gravitas. This is a guy who for years had been kind of the journeyman. He would be kind of akin to how we think of like maybe a Brad Dourif, or maybe even a little bit bigger than a Brad Dourif, but like a character actor who has leading man potential and a bit of the sinister side in him. I think it's those dark kind of beady black eyes, which is not pulp accurate, by the way. Kent Allard is described as having baby blues. I think Lamont Cranston is described as having blue eyes as well. So The Shadow, anytime you're reading the books, remember The Shadow has blue eyes. It's canonical. But in this case, Victor Jory, we swap out for black eyes. And you know what? It works. It absolutely does work. Victor Jory was also a favored choice of the late Walter Gibson. I'll now quote from an interview where he discussed the casting of the 1940 serial. Quote, Victor Jory was a good friend of mine. He's a magician. Yet another magician actor, by the way, Kane Richmond was as well. He knows all about magic, like I do too. He, of all things, played the Shadow, and he made a perfect Shadow. Now, there were two or three other Shadow movies. Rod LaRocque was in one, but the one that was most consistent was the serial, which Victor Jory played. And they had all of my old habitats in, like the Cobalt Club. Yes, indeed, the Cobalt Club does feature prominently in this. In fact, there's a bombing eventually of the Cobalt Club later on. Where Lamont Cranston used to stay, Police Commissioner Weston and Inspector Cardona, yes, they are both featured, all of those were characters that I created. One time, Dick Cooper wanted to set up a program involving people in a magic shop. I think he's talking about a movie or possibly a television show later on. And he talked about Victor and myself. Victor was playing in some historic play on Broadway that had to do with pilgrims or something. I stopped around to see him before the show. He was going on summer theater and was going to do The Spider, not the pulp hero, the play that Fulton Ausler wrote in which the murder was done on the stage or done in the audience. That was a very successful show. We talked about it then. Then he was down in Philadelphia. Frankie Bradley's was my hangout. I spotted him one time there and spent some time with him. Whenever I'd get a chance to see him, I would, which sadly wasn't too often. I didn't see him in later years, but he did a good Shadow. It was a very consistent type of thing. It had the Cobalt Club and it had other things. In other words, they took the highlights and they did what they wanted with them. And I thought it was very good, but still, it was only a serial. Our ingenue, Vita Ann Borg, deserves special mention, not only because crapping on Margot Lane has become elevated to an Olympic sport in the Shadow community, but because less than a year before filming this series, she was involved in a near-fatal car accident, in the aftermath of which that million-dollar face required surgical reconstruction, which was only about half-finished before she filmed this. So she had to kind of cake on the makeup a little bit, I guess, and they didn't film her heavily in close-up. I don't know, there's a few close-ups here. She looks beautiful. I don't know what in the world they're talking about, but apparently they kind of worked on it a little bit, but here she is, back and beautiful as ever. Her persistence paid off, and she would, I guess, after getting the remainder of her plastic surgery, she would land roles in major movies, such as the Oscar-winning Mildred Pierce, a film noir classic, and the John Wayne version of The Alamo. Oh, that little thing. I'm always a sucker for blonde Margot Lane. I know a lot of people insist on her being a brunette, as described in the books, but I don't know. Blonde Margot Lane works for me, and I think Vita Ann Borg was pretty good. She gets dumped on a little bit in reviews of this, I notice. And I just flat out disagree, I think. You know, try not to overthink this. It's a film serial. The woman's job is to be put in peril. Honestly, so is the man's, right? We have Harry Vincent here, who I'll talk about in a moment, and he's put in just as much peril, maybe even more than Margot Lane. Her job is to scream, and Harry's job is to get captured. And that's the way it was, and we liked it. And we tied an onion to her belt, which was the style at the time. But before we get to the rest of the cast and everything, I have to admit, the production is imperfect, while it wears its pulp inspirations on its sleeve. And indeed, we'll talk about the exact pulp stories and even review one of them a little bit later. Thanks to poor lighting and poor set design choices in places, not the whole time, that's the frustrating part of it. For the most part, this movie has the unbridled atmosphere of the feminine hygiene aisle at Walmart. I keep calling it a movie, but obviously it is a serial, but today it kind of plays more like a TV show or something, which is a shame because you're definitely not supposed to binge this. I did a little bit. I'd watch 3 or 4 episodes in one sitting, probably not the ideal way to watch and review this. Really, if you're going to review this serial or you're going to just watch it for enjoyment, what you need to do is you need to get a friend or your girlfriend or your wife or whatever, and one day a week, maybe every Saturday, just sit down and watch one episode and get through them slowly over the course of 15 weeks. That's how this was meant to be enjoyed and consumed, because one too many times the ceiling rubble falls on the Shadow and he, as the ending credits roll, you know, he's facing certain death in giant air quotes. The phrase certain death, folks, they just wear this phrase out, only for the next week for him to just literally shrug off the rubble. You can only do that so many times in a row before it becomes comical. And between that and the fight scenes, which they sped up and they have kind of a Keystone Cops vibe, yeah, it becomes sort of unintentionally humorous at a certain point. Sort of idiosyncratic in the same way that some of the more goofy refrains of the early James Bond films, right? Like the tank dragon and stuff like that from Dr. No, how some of that stuff comes off today. Either way, the combat sequences could use a touch-up or 20. I get that there had been a steady accretion of strictures against too much pistol packing, but with one or two exceptions, the gunplay in this serial is almost deliberately non-existent. When it does happen, it's pretty cool, except no one seems to hit anything. And that's rough. If you read the pulps, you know that Kent Allard, the Shadow, he never misses. He never misses. He's bullseye. Walter Gibson, a little bit later, in fact, in the story that we'll be reviewing today, The Lone Tiger, the Shadow misses his shots a number of times, and my jaw dropped. Because in most Shadow pulps, the Shadow hits what he's aiming at, period. He does not miss. In this, one of the only times that a bullet actually hits someone, it's Lamont Cranston. And it's used as a cringy plot device a little bit later to kind of give his identity away.
He's going to wipe them out. All of them. How? That wound on your wrist. I know who you are. You're Cranston.
And speaking of the adhesion to pulp inspirations, while Will Murray and Anthony Tallon argue the trilogy of the Green Hoods, the Silver Skull, and above all the Lone Tiger to be the sole informative element in the plot, that and the Prelude to Terror radio show. And indeed, there's documentation to back this up. These are the novels that they actually derived and actually licensed in order to make this film serial, I actually note a more than mere passing similarity with the Lester Dent Shadow yarn, The Golden Vulture. In fact, I think it's a lot closer in a lot of ways than The Lone Tiger. In that story, the eponymous villain communicates with his crook underlings via an elaborate network of golden vulture statues, which can both listen and speak. Not to mention, there's a chase sequence early in the book that's eerily familiar to fans of this film serial. Although some of that would have been stock footage, this thing was made on the cheap, and we'll talk about that in a moment. So look, in my half-wit headcanon, the Golden Vulture goes in this sort of rainbow stew, so to speak. I think it's a lot closer. I mean, there was only one sequence in The Silver Skull where the Shadow's down in this death pit and he's speaking to a Silver Skull that has an intercom but can't see him and can't talk to him back and forth, right? It's not two-way. And admittedly, it's very similar the way the explosion happens and the roof caves in on him and all that. So clearly, that was an inspiration for this serial. But this serial goes a step farther. There's an entire network of Black Tiger head statues that the Black Tiger, who is holding the city at ransom, he is attacking all of these industrialists, presumably, and they pretty much well identify this motivation early on. He is, in fact, an industrialist himself of unknown identity. It's soon kind of pared down to he must be one of the industrialists in the Cobalt Club, meeting with Lamont Cranston, who for some reason is a chemist and criminologist. I do not know why. I think it's because of the spider. Richard Wentworth in the Spider film serial is in a similar location. I think they even maybe reused some sets. And really the cast, his disguise, right? He has this doofy disguise in an eye patch and whatever. And here we have a disguise for Lamont Cranston, which is nothing new, except we've reversed. Lamont Cranston is the real guy and the Shadow is the disguise that he wears. That's the exact reverse from the pulps, of course. That's probably the biggest departure, to tell you the truth. This whole idea, this revelation that the Frank Millers of the world and Alan Moores of the world have had that, oh, did you know that Batman is the real person and Bruce Wayne is the mask? Ho, 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 how clever am I? It's like, congratulations, you got where the Shadow was in 1931. You know what I mean? The Shadow is the real person. Kent Allard may not even be the real person when you break it down. Lamont Cranston's a mask he wears, and in a lot of ways, Ken Allard is a mask he wears. Even if it is his true identity, the Shadow is who he really is now. He's a spy master in a war on crime, right? But what they've purloined from the pulps is infinitely less remarkable than what they've added. Yes, fellow agents, an all-new superpower. The Shadow is officially invulnerable to explosions and ceiling rubble. Power would have come in handy in more than a few pulp and comic book stories I can recall offhand. I don't know if there is a standing object in all of New York that isn't dropped on the dome of Lamont Cranston over the course of this serial. And he no-sells it harder than John Cena's male pattern baldness. But he's Victor Jory, folks. He fears no rubble. Indeed, Victor Jory went on record saying that the Shadow film serial was far and away the thing he was most often recognized for later in life, and that it likely would remain his enduring cinematic legacy. Gang, Victor Jory was in Gone with the Wind. So yeah, you could say the Shadow film serial was slightly successful in its day. But let us return to the cast. Roger Moore, no, not that Roger Moore, plays Harry Vincent. Yes, friends, our boy Harry Vincent finally done found his way into a piece of Shadow media. Although he's honestly more of an agglomerative composite of Harry Vincent and Mo Shrevenitz, who he explains, I think at the beginning of the first episode of the serial, Moshe Shrevenitz, I think, was supposed to be in an earlier draft of the script. They must have dropped him for budgetary constraints. Again, we'll talk about the budgetary constraints a little bit later. But Harry Vincent explains that, oh, Moshe Shrevenitz is taking a break for a while, so I'm the driver. I think in the fifth episode, he literally says, I drive the cab.
Well, how come you're not going up with him? I drive a cab.
That's kind of what Harry Vincent has been reduced down to. Honestly, he's been reduced to kind of a last name only, kind of a share thing going on, where he's more often than not just called Vincent. I don't think it's till like the last or maybe penultimate serial episode where Margot Lane actually calls him Harry at a certain point. That's it. But no matter how many times he gets behind the wheel of that cab, no matter how many times he's relegated to the status of the Shadow's glorified chauffeur, we know he gets near killed and kidnapped entirely too many times for him to be anyone but our boy Harry.
Make it sound natural or else.
Hello, Mr. Cranston. This is Vincent.
Yeah, sure, I'm all right. Can you come and pick me up at Norton's Crossroads?
Oh, some excitement.
That's a fine name for it.
I saw all of the Black Tigers men leaving here.
Yeah, and they got that new invention of yours.
We did the best we could.
Well, don't worry about that. I wanted them to get it. I made that machine expressly for the Black Tigers.
What? And I took that beating trying to keep them from getting something that you wanted them to have?
That's right.
Oh, boss.
I thought you were going to use it against him.
I am. The Black Tiger thinks it's a short wavefinder, and that's what I want him to think. Actually, it's a wireless dictograph.
Oh, I'm sorry, Harry.
And while we're on the subject, you know, Roger Moore, the other one, the one you actually know, he would have made a damn fine Lamont Cranston, would he not? You know, he kind of has that waspy transatlantic, especially when he was working in America, like doing Maverick and some of the stuff where he, you know, his accent got a little less British and a little more transatlantic. He would not have been a bad Lamont Cranston, just in my personal opinion. We alluded to the subpar production values and the Shadow running around in his full Shadow outfit, which is supposed to be relegated for nighttime in the pulps. He's running around in broad daylight in this thing. We alluded to all this kind of stuff. And it's a crying-ass shame the damn thing looks the way it does, because the Black Tiger transformation sequences, you know, foggy, filmed in silhouette, and steeped in mysterioso atmosphere, amply illustrate that the filmmakers could have shot this entire thing in a style that actually befitted the Dark Avenger. Instead, flat white walls and gray basements abound, and even in darkest night, some Liren retard decided to leave the lights on. Just watch this sequence, for those of you on YouTube, of course, and imagine if every introduction of the Shadow was similarly atmospheric.
Places, man. Here he comes now.
Come on, Harvey.
The boss.
Attention, men. I know you have been wondering what makes me invisible to you.
Makes you want to punch the producer, don't it? And I suspect the director was cognizant of the error, because by the final four chapters, the lighting looks more and more film noir, and nighttime sequences become more and more prolific. It's just a shame this cinematographer failed to flip off the light switch until the final four episodes for some reason. In fairness to the filmmakers, I guess low-light location shooting was a relative rarity in the 1940s. Yeah, film noir was really dark, but actually, when you analyze the lighting setups, it was very, very strategic. Read the book Painting with Light by John Alton. It'll really kind of sort out for you. It wasn't so much that 1940s and 30s like film noir sets were badly lit. Whatever Robert Mitchum says. I think he famously said in Out of the Past, an interview about Out of the Past, we had no money, so our set was lit with cigarettes, right? Something like that. But it's not really true. It's more so strategic lighting. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the camera lenses that could pick up enough light sufficient to the task, they didn't come around to the late 1970s. And as such, even night scenes in the Shadow serial are almost always day scenes with sunglasses on. As Mystery Science Theater 3000 taught us, day for night photography is dick-flatteningly awful, but it was standard cinematic practice until about the 1980s. Speaking of those transformation sequences, though, the Black Tiger, the villain, is handled better all around than the Shadow is. While the Shadow's explicitly Lamont Cranston, and we even witness him changing into other outfits, Aretha Franklin style, which really takes some wind out of his sails, the Black Tiger's identity is a jealously guarded secret. The director, I love this, he even goes so far as to cast two or three separate actors among the industrialists who are suspected of being the Black Tiger, who all have that similar high-pitched nasally voice that the Black Tiger has, and he drops multiple tempting red herrings on our heads to just sort of throw us off the scent.
See, you private citizens don't give the police enough consideration. And that's why the same law that protects a man until he's found guilty protects the criminal, too. And it's a situation like this that makes a fiend like the Black Tiger possible.
But one man can't defy the law.
No. Well, what would you say if on mere suspicion you were arrested as the Black Tiger?
Me? Why, well, that's ridiculous. No one could think that I'm the Black Tiger.
No, it isn't ridiculous. In the first place, the Black Tiger isn't an ordinary criminal. He's a man of great brains, even if they all walked. He's a great executive leader, and he's an organizer. So you or any of our civic leaders might be the Black Tiger. As a matter of fact, the way things stand right now, even I am under suspicion.
You?
Much like the pulps and the radio shows it was inspired by, this serial is somewhat prescient, at least on the technological front. As such, it features such modern contrivances as aerial EMP weapons, magnetic shielding from EMP weapons, cellular phones, and even at one point, radio-controlled drone aircraft. This serial features live-action renditions of some truly iconic pulp scenes, so this stuff is kind of plucked right from the pages. From the Shadow infiltrating a crooked sanatorium in disguise, to Lamont Cranston being saved by the Shadow?
Cranston, you meddler. I've waited a long time for this. The Shadow!
Good work, Vincent. That'll give him something to think about.
And let us not forget the classic cape and a hat on a chair to fool the mobsmen who are about to shoot the Shadow in the head trick. Even the titles of the individual episodes appear swiped straight from the pages of the Shadow magazine. I feel like I've read chapters called The Sealed Room and The Underground Trap at least a dozen times in the Shadow stories. And as Bernie would say, that's a good thing. That's a very, very good thing. What Bernie probably wouldn't like is the character of Lin Chang.
You stay here, Chang. We don't want anyone loose who knows about this job till it's over.
Oh, you don't trust me.
Guys in my game, we don't trust anyone, savvy?
Lin Chang, a double identity of Lamont Cranston in a disguise that he employs in order to occupy the underworld, and I don't think I've read a single review of this serial that has not whined ad astra about quote-unquote yellow face and all that. I don't think there is a bigger pet peeve of mine than contemporary, particularly retards from academia, who place modern standards, impose them, really, on old media, decades-old media. This serial is from 1940, gang. We're coming up on, what, 80 years of this. And we're going to judge this by the standards of 2025. standards that, if our society is any indication, I mean, we're not exactly hopping as a society and culture right now, right? And yet we're going to presume that we have absolutely everything figured out as a culture and as a society today compared to the 1940s. It just, there's a level of presumption to it and an egotism and a vanity. And here's my problem with it when it comes right down to it. And I'm not going to get up on my soapbox here or anything, but, you know, basically there's a level of presumption that you in the modern day have decided what the default with regard to anything, society, socio-politically, is, right? Here's my problem with that. You're lamenting something that is featured in a serial written by people who were assuming the exact same thing in their time period. You are no better than them. You're worse in some ways because you've had decades to analyze this fact and you're such a midwit, you couldn't put two and two together. It's a film serial. It's a character. It's played for laughs, by the way. It's mostly given to Victor Jory to show his remarkable range as an actor. And in that sense, it's very, very successful. It's not the only disguise he employs, by the way. He actually disguises himself as a phone repairman. That's what it is. He disguises himself as a phone repairman, a very, very Kent Allard the Shadow kind of thing to do. And he plays that in a similar way, just for laughs. Very, very cartoony. It's a film serial. It's primarily playing to adolescents. It cannot hurt you. Get over it. But audiences of 1940 did not get over it. The Shadow was, needless to say, exploding in popularity around this time. Around this same period, Lou Cantor and Hugh Skeely licensed the rights to adapt a 1939 Shadow radio episode called Mansion of Madness into a stage play, which is just another indicator of how popular this character was at the time, though it ultimately fell through. It was going to tour the country, by the way. They had structured the whole thing so that literally the whole set was just black curtains so that they could more easily put it up into suitcases and lug it all around the country. They were thinking cost effective. This is intended to be a traveling, touring show, right? They were really looking to make some money off it, but it ultimately fell through. And though it fell through, a script has in fact survived. And to give you an idea of how wildly adaptations of this character differed in this era, not only was the Shadow never seen in his slouch hat and cape, much less wielding a gun, he never physically appears in the play at all. He is simply heard over the loudspeaker through use of his famous filter microphone from the radio program. Though he does introduce and outreduce the play in the classic style of the original radio drama. So at least there's that. Speaking of mixing and matching here, it's worth mentioning that mixing elements from all the different stuff, you know, mixing the radio version with the comic version, with the pulp, this is something that Walter B. Gibson, the creator of The Shadow, was not opposed to, which really makes it tragic that he died 9 years before the 1994 Shadow film came out. It makes you wonder if he would have enjoyed it. I tend to think he probably would have, because perhaps most potently blended all three of those elements and on a far bigger budget than the 1940 film serial. I'll now quote from a Walter Gibson interview where he discussed that. Quote, "I feel that in the Shadow movies that they did, they tried to stay reasonably close to the character and delineate it. It's perfectly all right to use anything that sounded good on the radio. The plots seem to be new, but they were in keeping with it, practically all of them. As I say, it was ideally done in the serial. I thought Victor Jory was just the person for it. I'd like to see the new one follow that same pattern." They were, at the time, by the way, brewing up several different Shadow scripts. I think it was 1982, there's a script that you can read online that actually would have provided not only a Shadow script, it involved Margot Lane and the Shadow was actually played by a very kind of waspy, transatlantic, kind of British guy, and very interesting choices, actually. We kind of missed out on this, but we really missed out because it was going to include the Great War origin, the Kent Allard origin, him behind enemy lines doing spycraft, and it was going to provide an origin for the Shadow, and a real one, not the 1994 Tolku Tibet kind of origin. So that's what he's referring to. I'd like to see the new one. That would have been the new one at the time. They were making a script in 82, and they made a script in 85 as well that was a little bit closer to the radio version, but neither of those got made. It wasn't until 1994 that it got out of development hell. For example, take Sherlock Holmes. You couldn't have done better than having gotten Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce to play the parts of Holmes and Watson. You'd have thought that they were the same people the story was written about. They were wonderful. He speculated as to some of the actors that he would choose. But it's an interesting idea, this mixing of the different media. It kind of comes from Walter Gibson, and that's probably why David Koepp and the filmmaker Russell Mulcahy and all the people working on the movie in 1994 sort of had license to do that with their script version. And the next time you criticize it for mixing all those elements, remember it's kind of endorsed by Walter Gibson. He was cool with that. And the radio version is particularly worth mentioning here, as thanks to a really curious rights arrangement between Columbia, Street and Smith, and the makers of the radio show, which I think was what, Ruthrof and Ryan, right? The radio program enjoyed complete autonomy and right of first refusal with regard to their sponsors, right? They had Kerry Salt, they had the Silvertown, Safety Silvertown tires and all of Blue Coal and so forth. They had right of first refusal. That's why their sponsors were so famous and still are today. But what this means is, despite the fact that it was advertised in both the magazine and on radio, if Ruthrof and Ryan had wished to advertise for Columbia's direct competitor, like, say, Warner Brothers, at the exact same time that the Columbia serial was in theaters, they enjoyed every legal right to do so. That is a really unconventional arrangement to this day. By the way, speaking of the serial, how successful was it? I mean, they had a big campaign behind it. They suggested that you have an employee in the theater who was actually dressed like the Shadow to kind of usher people, maybe dress up the usher as someone like the Shadow or something. They had a whole slew of merchandise that was only made available to the theater owners. So this stuff you could only get in the theater if you went to see the Shadow serial. In fact, most of the merchandise claimed today, even by noted Shadow historians, you'll see them in some of their scrapbooks and biographical books and stuff about the Shadow, that they often will claim are attached to the radio show or later comic book adaptations or whatever. You know, stuff like the Shadow stationery, Shadow makeup kits, Shadow gun holsters, and on and on. It was, in fact, a tie-in to the theater chains that showed the 15-chapter Shadow film serial and not the radio show at all. The Shadow 1940 serial was sort of the reverse of the Spider serial, which had been, I think, 1937, just a couple of years before this. This is a big character on a tiny budget. The Spider serial that aired prior to this had boku bucks by way of budget, and it lost all that money at the box office because the Spider, while popular, is not Shadow popular. So the idea here was spend all the bank acquiring the license to a popular character and then spend pennies to actually produce the thing. So if this thing looks cheap, and it often does at times, that's why it's so well lit. That's why you only have nice lighting setups in the Black Tiger transformation sequences. And then toward the end of the serial, it's like the director, as I said, becomes a little bit more conscious of the fact that, hey, wait, this is a Shadow serial. Maybe we should turn the lights down a little bit. But for the most part, it's bright daytime. The Shadow's climbing on the side of a building. 500 people walking down the street should be able to see the Shadow climbing all over the building. It's cool. You do want the Shadow to be doing stuff like that. That is featured in the pulp, although usually with suction cups and whatnot. But it just, you can see the budget is there on the screen, which means it's not there. I have my gripes, just as Walter B. Gibson had his gripes. But the Shadow film serial, to this day, I put right alongside the 1994 film as the closest attempt to really bring this character to the screen. And in terms of the actual pulp incarnation, it's probably just a hair closer than the Alec Baldwin film. Although, I think the Alec Baldwin film probably gets closer to the look, at least of the character on the cover of the comic books and pulps. Not so much that judge's robe, all black clad vigilante version of the character that we see in those beautiful Tom Lavelle and Cartier Orban illustrations that just sort of haunt our waking nightmares to this day, and that, of course, we can't get enough of. Folks, I highly recommend the 1940 Shadow film serial. It is actually commercially available in what I would generously term the gray market. It's also on YouTube, but I think you want this for yourself. I think you want a physical copy of this. And speaking of things you want a copy of, but probably can't get for under a grand now, or at least under a few hundred dollars, how about the Shadow Pulps? How about The Lone Tiger? The pulp novel reputed to be the basis for this serial, and in fact, I would argue, as we'll be going over the course of this story, a somewhat tenuous connection. Really, there's very, very little of this pulp novel that winds up on the screen. There's, in fact, far more elements from a prior story called The Silver Skull. We'll be talking about all three of the stories that were licensed for this and a little bit of The Golden Vulture, which I think was also kind of plundered a little bit, and only they didn't pay for the license. They just used The Silver Skull as kind of a smokescreen and copied and cribbed a lot of stuff from Golden Vulture, I think. A millionaire by the name of Mileson. This is a fantastic introduction to the story and the central conflict, and I love this character of Mileson. I love also that they don't do the obvious thing with Mileson, but we get some proper pathos. This always bugged me when I reviewed the 1994 Shadow film. What did I say? You don't need the Shadow to have pathos. If somebody winds up making a new Shadow film, don't worry about making your hero tortured. The Shadow isn't tortured. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's a spy master in a war on crime. However, he came to that, and his origin is actually interesting. There's actually motivations behind that, but it's not a tortured motivation. He sees evil, and he stamps it out. End of. All right, that's the Shadow. He's witnessed evil. He witnessed unspeakable generational evil in the trenches of the Great War, behind enemy lines, in prison camps, which he liberated behind enemy lines. We don't need much more explanation than that, right? The pathos comes from who? The proxy heroes, the secondary characters. And indeed, the character of Marion and the character of Mileson in particular. These are characters who have a tremendous amount of pathos, especially Mileson. It is explained that there is a group called the Tiger Mob under the tutelage of a crime boss called the Lone Tiger, who carry off these brazen heists of wealthy industrialists and banks and all manner of high-profile targets. So these guys were an absolute scourge for a number of years, and we get that sense. But really where we get the personal motivation and the pathos that I alluded to earlier is that Mileson's family is targeted because he is uniquely wealthy. He is filthy, stinking rich. And no one is harmed. They don't mean, the Tiger Mob doesn't mean to kill anyone. But his daughter, Dorothy, probably a reference to Wizard of Oz, by the way, Walter B. Gibson's favorite book series, A Man of True Taste. Dorothy is locked down in the wine cellar, a very, very cold wine cellar. This is, guys, this is New England. Very, very cold. Down in the wine cellar, the whole family's locked down there. Everybody else is fine. They're just really, really cold. But she's ill. And after having rallied from her illness, after this event, she winds up being hospitalized. And ultimately, she succumbs and dies. And so the Tiger Mob, without intending to really, wind up inadvertently murdering this man's daughter by making her succumb to her own illness. And Mileson is absolutely obsessed. He is a man possessed in his quest to bring the Lone Tiger to justice, because even though the Tiger Mob is ultimately rounded up and dispersed to the four winds, the Lone Tiger is to this point not brought to justice. This is a great one. It's interesting. I had read a review of this particular story that did not rank it very high in the Shadow Pantheon. And so it had a pretty low score in a book called The Shadow in Review, which is basically just a gigantic tome that reviews every single Shadow pulp story in chronological order. Really good book, actually. But the author of that book, John Olson, did not rank this story high. And so I was kind of dreading it. I was going into this, I was wondering. I didn't read his review ahead of time to see what his problem was, but I was really, really worried about it. I found myself halfway through, having consumed this story almost in one sitting, wondering what on earth was this guy on about. Incidentally, I was sitting like poolside. It's the heart of summer in Phoenix, right? So I'm sitting by the pool reading this thing. I should be swimming and enjoying myself, but instead I'm enjoying myself just wrapped up in a Shadow pulp. And this story just grabbed me. It was fantastic. The motivation of Mileson, the kind of red herring characters, Beak Bartlett, and this kind of hump private detective who's thrown in the mid, any of them could be the lone tiger. Indeed, the most obvious suspicion that you have is, well, who's the most wealthy person here? Who's the most obsessed? Who would be the most misdirective choice? It's the proxy hero, right? Mileson. And I thought maybe they were going to go in that direction. They don't. They don't go that direction. Light spoiler. Not really a spoiler. I'm not going to give away the identity of the lone tiger because you really want to read this one. This one really moves. There's not a lot of wasted motion. Only one or two chapters I thought maybe were a little bit redundant. But this is a period in the Shadow's history. This was published in 1939, a time when Walter Gibson was cranking out two Shadow pulps a month. And for them to still be this good, this deep, is pretty baffling. Walter B. Gibson was a literary treasure. He should take his place in the pantheon of the all-time great writers, if for no other reason than sheer volume. But the truth is, putting aside the volume, this is a guy who created an icon. This is a guy who is arguably more singularly responsible for the superhero phenomenon than any other literary character. And yet you never hear about Walter Gibson. Ever. You'll hear about Bob Kane and all the people who wound up ripping him off, but you will never hear about Walter Gibson in any discussions of truly iconic writers of that period. The Lone Tiger is exemplary of this phenomenon. He deserves his flowers for this one. The Lone Tiger today is probably most infamous among Shadow fans for its cover. It is, of course, the only extant example of a Shadow cover that features at least all of the main Shadow agents on it. Which is funny because it's shown, it seems to be in the Shadow's sanctum, right? None of the agents, to my knowledge, ever really wind up in the Shadow's sanctum. I've read dozens of Shadow pulps. I gotta be nearing maybe the 100 mark. I've read a lot of them, folks. I have never read a story where any of the agents wind up in the sanctum. A few villains and a corpse on one occasion winds up in the Shadow's sanctum. But the actual agents are not taken to the Shadow's sanctum usually. But this cover, of course, features Moshe Revnitz, Clyde Burke, Jericho Druk, who only pops into the story for just a second. Jericho Druk was part of the second wave of agents that were introduced, I think, in Crime Insured, along with Pietro and all these guys who sort of had to replace the previous agents just for that story. But Jericho Druk, Cliff Marsland, Burbank, Harry Vincent, Hawkeye, and of course, the Shadow. But of course, the coolest detail about this cover is Walter B. Gibson was interviewed years and years and years ago and asked, like, what was the idea? What was the conception behind the idea of the agents? Because no other character has this. Like, Doc Savage imitated it with his kind of, but that was a very close-knit group of kind of the greatest minds of his day. But what was the idea behind these agents? And Walter B. Gibson came up with a very interesting answer, and it makes a lot of sense. King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. So if you look at this cover, it is no coincidence that the Shadow and his agents are arrayed around what? A round table. I'll say this, though, like, of the trilogy of the novels that are supposed to have informed the Shadow film serial, Lone Tiger might be the weakest, but all three, and really I would extend that to all four, are very, very strong. The four Shadow novels that I believe informed the Shadow film serial from 1940 are among the strongest entries. I mean, if you're going to pick anything as a basis to make this film serial, you could have done a lot worse than these. Beginning with The Golden Vulture, which is a Lester Dent written story, actually, who would be better known as, of course, the creator of Doc Savage and a great pulpiteer in his own right. It was kind of an audition. They were thinking, okay, Walter Gibson is cranking out two stories a month. We should probably cycle in a new writer or two just to supplement him, to kind of help him. Walter Gibson initially took offense to that and then realized, you know what, I actually probably could use a little help. And then he met Theodore Tinsley and they got along famously. And Walter Gibson was, of course, interviewed years later and said, gosh, I liked Theodore Tinsley's stories. I thought he did my characters justice. He said the same thing about Lester Dent, who, of course, Walter Gibson and Lester Dent would go on to co-create. Yes, the creator of Doc Savage and the creator of The Shadow had a top 10 anime team up, and who did they create? The Avenger, probably one of the most underrated characters in all of pulpdom. The Golden Vulture, like a lot of Lester Dent stories, is very action-packed. Lots of chases and fights and near misses and all the stuff you expect from Doc Savage stories, which I've been reading a lot recently as well. But there's this great Machiavellian edge, and that probably comes from, I believe Walter Gibson came in and did the final draft on it. So he took the Lester Dent story and he sort of polished it up and gave it the Gibson treatment. And so that's probably where the sort of Machiavellian lone tiger type figure, the black tiger figure of the Golden Vulture with the sort of surveillance vulture statues and such, that's probably where that comes from. The Mysterioso element probably is more of a Gibson contrivance. And the Golden Vulture, of course, is featured in the very first volume of the Sanctum reprints. And that is actually one that I find is a little bit more common to actually find on storefronts online. It seems like the first like 10 or 15 of the Shadow reprints are pretty easy to find. Not the first 15 Shadow stories, mind you. They were all, of course, reprinted out of order. But the Golden Vulture and all that kind of the Salamanders, all that early stuff tends to be a little bit easier to find than some of the later stuff that reprints, the Living Shadow, that's impossible to find. The Eyes of the Shadow, impossible to find. You got to get the yellow paperbacks to be able to read those. But it's a little bit easier to find. So if you want to read the Golden Vulture and see what I'm talking about with this, I think you'll agree with me. There are some elements from the Golden Vulture here, and I highly recommend that story. I also recommend, and heartily so, the Green Hoods. This is a Kent Allard adventure, of course. This is the period after, in fact, I believe this is one of the very first stories that was written after it was revealed that Kent Allard was, in fact, the Shadow. It simply wasn't published until 1938, a lot later. It was months and months later after, and this often happened, right? These things were written at a certain time and then they'd be published later. Sometimes they would be held back. You'd have a backlog and then you'd have to burn through it when Walter took a break or something like that. That was common practice. And that's why, by the way, Walter Gibson wrote under the pen name of Maxwell Grant. You had to be able to cycle in other writers if you needed to. It's a house name, right? But in 1937, of course, after years of false identities and gallivanting about as Lamont Cranston, the wealthy young man about town, the popularity of the Orson Welles radio drama prompted Walter B. Gibson to finally settle on a single alter ego, you all know it, Kent Allard, the Black Eagle. He's sort of, to describe him, he's sort of an American answer to the Red Baron. His aviation exploits as a fighter pilot in the Great War were in fact a blind for counterintelligence and espionage on behalf of the Entente behind German enemy lines. And of course, those are tactics he would later employ as the spymaster in his eternal war on crime, The Shadow. Again, this is one of the first stories written after this revelation, and it's clear from the outset, while Allard is formidable, there is something about him, in this story anyways, that just has not clicked yet. He's more mysterious than Cranston. He is definitely more powerful, but somehow, at least at this juncture, he's just not as compelling. And the way Walter Gibson writes it, like, oh, he's Allard, it just kind of lies there, as opposed to everything else about the Shadow, which has been more inference and mystery and hinting, right? So you lost a little bit of that. Fortunately, in this story, at least for the purposes of this narrative, Allard is treated a little bit more like a front. This is what I mean, like when I said earlier, the Shadow is the real identity. Allard is in that sense. Even if it's his real identity, Allard is kind of a front. In his daily life, he is not Kent Allard. In his daily life, he is the Shadow. A secret society of crime fighters, the titular Green Hoods, are betrayed from within to acquire a miraculous invention, which is an unerring new form of lie detector machine that uses gas and actually hooks up physically to both participants, both the person asking the questions and the interrogated. It's called a truth inducer, and only the Shadow has all the crucial clues, and there are many of them in this story, that are required to bring the Archfiend to justice. In this story, the Dark Avenger is just in his pulp prime. His automatics are eternally barking. His deductions are as inscrutable as they are ingenious. He may have shed the mystery of his true identity, but he still functions as an ominous creature of the night when he is in shadow mode. The Green Hood seems initially to you as if it might be a generic supervillain story, right? Because there's a guy running around in a green robe. After the Green Hoods are wiped out, it's at the beginning of the story. This is not a spoiler, by the way. This happens in like the first chapter. The Green Hoods are basically wiped out at the beginning of the story because their leader is killed. And so now there's just one Green Hood. So you think it's sort of a supervillain story, but it soon settles into one of the most addicting murder mysteries Gibson ever penned. No wonder it wound up being partial source material here for the Shadow film serial. The Green Hoods is also noteworthy. Actually, all of these stories are, now that I think about it, in that it doesn't feature a proxy hero, but it features a proxy heroine. Now, Street and Smith were notorious for having restrictions on sexuality, and as such, especially harm to women, not just sexuality, but any harm coming to women, they balked and vomited. Women rarely were featured in early Shadow stories, hence having one as self-possessed, as full of beans, and able to conquer the world as this without resorting to sort of tawdry elements for the sake of sex appeal, you know, a torn dress, which does show up in one of the later stories we'll talk about. It makes the character of Evelyn Rail is her name. She's a standout in the series, and yet sadly, despite functioning as a competent agent for the duration of this story, she is never formally recruited. She sort of provides the mold for what Margot Lane would be when she was finally introduced to the pulps. This one does not let up. I think it might be the strongest of the bunch that we're going to talk about here. Golden Vulture's great, but I think Green Hoods is a little bit better. I highly recommend this one. This brings us to the Silver Skull. Man, I really would like to dedicate a whole episode to this one because this one's great, but just in brief, I guess the summary is a series of mysterious plane crashes in the Rocky Mountains leave men of wealth and industry dead and a masked murderer their only beneficiary, and each death is demarcated by a murderous token left at the scene, a silver skull. This story is a whiplash affair. It is a trim 19 chapters of nonstop pulp action. Walter Gibson has shed many of his slow-building novelist sensibilities. He's become a polished pulpiteer by this point. And while the pace benefits tremendously, I have to admit there was a slightly muddled quality to the plotting and maybe to some of the descriptions of the scenes that is not usually seen in Gibson's work up until this point. It's a riveting read, but something about it just feels rushed. I remember having to reread paragraphs over again, going, was that just me? Am I sleep deprived? Is there something wrong with my brain? Or no, in rereading them, I found they were poorly described. Like, sometimes you would get confused about where things were laid out, where a hallway was, where a door was, where a character was standing, and sometimes things would be written strangely. Walter Gibson has a habit of replacing the word and with a comma. A lot of times there's a lot of that, and sometimes that can make things really, really muddled. But cut the man some slack. By 1939, Walter Gibson, as I said, was writing two new Shadow stories a month. Also, again, rarely seen in his work, this is another story that features a female proxy hero, but it features something else. An honest-to-God femme fatale, a pistol-packing nurse, no less. It's one of these passages that I will highlight as exemplary of Gibson's superb prose, which I will now quote. I love this. I love that. This is near the end of the... They have just assailed a base, a hidden base, and this femme fatale draws a gun and squares up with the Shadow, and you're wondering for a moment, is he going to waste this woman? Are we going to see the Shadow gun down a female? Which has not happened to this point. Quote, her eyes met the Shadow's burning gaze, a looming muzzle just below. The smoke that curled from the automatic's mouth denoted its hunger for more prey, and Thelma knew that she was eligible. Her lips twisted in a ruddy writhe, but the snarl that came from them was almost soundless. Numbly opening her hand, Thelma let her revolver drop. The Shadow greeted that submission with a mocking laugh. That is just... that is pulp poetry. This story represents, sadly, the Shadow's final prosaic appearance as his true alter ego, Kent Allard, which is lamentable, as in many ways, this is the ultimate Kent Allard shadow story. The Black Eagle's aviation exploits here are ubiquitous. He survives a plane crash. He lands in the middle of a craggy desert in the Rockies without the benefit of a runway to do battle with an airbase full of baddies, culminating in a blazing mid-air dogfight between a machine gun-wielding Silver Skull and the Shadow's autogyro. Just as Kent Allard is getting interesting, he's gone, replaced permanently by Lamont Cranston. All I can say is, what a waste. Silver Skull, indeed, the Shadow magazine in general, is proof that you don't have to keep your villains alive to have a thriving, credibly threatening rogues gallery. Pyramids of lead-ravaged mobbies accumulated Allard's feet, 145 fusillade at a time, and yet the threat of the Silver Skull is ever-present and far more ominous than the modern comic villains they inspired. When the Shadow nearly dies twice, we are stunned because this fate was rarely inflicted upon such a seemingly superhuman character. Take notes on tension, my fellow authors. And those are your sources, along with the radio episode Prelude to Terror, which is really not plumbed that heavily. It just was used for the sort of plot conceit of the exploding light bulbs that are introduced not once but twice in the Shadow film serial. Those were reused from the episode Prelude to Terror. Really, that's mostly what they plundered these pulp stories for. It was little devices and moments here and there. I do have to say this. Almost nothing from the Green Hoods was taken for the Shadow serial. Apparently, the lone indulgence was a sequence in an episode of the serial where Lamont Cranston infiltrates the Black Tiger's mob in a disguise. He's wearing a face mask. Everyone is required to conceal their identities, and the Shadow takes advantage of this by concealing himself, and ultimately he's found out, and a fight ensues, Keystone Cops style, and all of that fun stuff. So it's a fun little episode of the serial, but that's it. That's all they took from the Green Hoods, which is funny, because I think the Green Hoods is the strongest of all the stories, but all these are bangers. I love the Lone Tiger, I love the Silver Skull, I love the Green Hoods, and I love the Golden Vulture, and while we're at it, Prelude to Terror is a fine episode of the radio drama. Folks, this has been a double long episode, and that's because we had to cover 15 episodes of a film serial to talk about the history of the Shadow on the silver screen, an extensive history that is all too often discounted. But folks, until next time...
You reap evil. Crime does not pay. A Shadow knows.
The Black Tiger is dead. You will find his body at the Arcade Garage.
Who is this?